We're holding Parshas Vayechi, the last Parsha in the Book of Bereishis. And our Parsha brings the period of Yaakov, Jacob, and the 12 tribes to a close. We will try to run through the Parsha, and then we'll see if we have extra time. Maybe we will do an overview of the Book of Bereishis. Quick review. Our parasha is called Vayichi. It's interesting that the parashas that record death are called after the life. The parasha Chayei Sarah that records Sarah's passing is called Chayei Sarah, the life of Sarah. Parasha Vayichi, which focuses on Yaakov's passing and then the rest of the tribe's passing, is called Vayichi and live. It's always good to focus on the positive. So we'll quickly get an overview of the parasha. The parasha records that Yaakov aged after 17 years in Egypt. He realized that he doesn't have much time left. He calls in his son Yosef and asks him to take a vow that he will take him up the land of Israel to be buried. And Yosef takes the vow. Time after that, Yaakov gets sick, and Yosef comes by with his two children, and Yaakov strengthens himself. He sits up on the bed, and he blesses Yosef's two children. And when Yosef brings his two children forward, so he takes the elder one, Menashe, and he ensures that he is on Yaakov's right, and he takes the younger one, Ephraim, and he ensures that he will be on Yaakov's left. And Yaakov, anticipating this, switches his hand, he crisscrosses his hand to ensure that his right hand goes on the younger brother, and he starts blessing them, and Yosef sees this and he thinks his father got confused. He says, "Dad, no, that's not right. The elder one is here on your right. Put your right hand on him." And Yaakov tells him, "Yadati bni yadati, I know he's also going to be successful, but his younger brother is going to be greater, and that's why he deserves to have the right hand placed on him." Yaakov blesses Yosef, and in blessing him, he also gives him a double portion, the rights of the firstborn, that his two children, Ephraim and Menashe, will be considered like two tribes. So Yosef is getting a double portion. And Yaakov calls his children together, we're holding by Ravi, and tells them, "I want to tell you what's going to be at the end of the days." Which days is he referring to? Is he talking about the end of time, the time of the Mashiach, or the end of this exile in Egypt? He calls his children in and he starts giving them a speech one by one. He tells Reuven, "You had such potential, you were my firstborn, you were representative of my strength, and look, you rushed, you were angry, and you lost it all. Shimon and Levi, you two use improper tools, you use weapons improperly. I don't want to have anything to do with the sins of your future. Your past has shown you, in your anger, you murdered and you wanted to uproot your brother Yosef. Cursed is your anger, how strong it is. You have to be scattered among the Jewish people. We can't leave you together after you've shown such traits. Yehuda, don't be scared, come back. Everyone's going to praise after you're willing to admit your wrongdoings with Tamar. I don't have to rebuke you over that. Rather, you can be proud because of what you did. Tamar wasn't killed. Her two fetuses who ended up being her two children, your two children, they weren't killed because you were brave enough to stand up and admit. Yehuda, you're like a lion. Who could stand against you? Yehuda, you will merit to be the leader of the Jewish people, and the leadership will remain within the tribe of Yehuda. Your portion in the land of Israel is filled with wine," which can be understood literally or can be understood representative of Tamidei Chachamim. We know that Yayin represents Sod. Yayin is the gematria of Sod. The numerical value of Yud Yud Nun is 70, as is the numerical value of Sod. Because when you see a grape, you have anav, and after you squeeze out the grape and let it ferment, that's when you get the Yayin. That's like the Sod, the secret, something that has to be taken out. So the portion of Yehuda is going to be filled with wine, however we understand it, so filled with wine that Yaakov says they'll use it for laundering their clothing. It doesn't mean literally, but it means like it'll be common like water. And the eyes, everyone's going to be have red eyes from wine, like drunk people have red eyes after they drink a lot of wine, and white teeth, they'll have so much milk, meaning there'll be a lot of plenty in the land of Yehuda. Zvolun, you're going to live on the outskirts by the sea, and you're going to be a sailor. Yisachar is comparable to a donkey. Donkey never gets to rest. He's always working. He rests on the job. In travel, he sits down and rests. And you, Yisachar, you recognize the good in having a break and resting. So you took the yoke of Torah, which requires that a person have a calm life. And that's why you made this deal, Yisachar and Zvolun, that Zvolun goes out to work and you stay home and learn, and then you divide both portions. And that's why Zvolun, who is younger than Yisachar, is mentioned before Yisachar. Really, Zvolun should have been mentioned after Yisachar. The idea is that because Zvolun was giving part of his income to Yisachar so that Yisachar could learn, so Zvolun merited to be mentioned first. Dan is going to be a judge, an unusual judge. Yaakov is prophesizing about Shimshon Samson, who's like a snake, just like a snake goes out on his own. Wolves go out in packs, but snakes go on their own. Snakes have cunning. So too Shimshon. And there are many, many areas where Shimshon is compared to a snake. So too is the tribe of Dan. And I wait for your salvation, Hashem. Yaakov foresees that Samson is going to have a terrible end. God has tremendous strength. He has his fat bread is from the tribe of Asher. Asher has a lot of oil in his portion. Naphtali is swift. He's always swift to bring back good news. They're like a young ram, an ayala. And then we come to Yosef, and now Yaakov expands a lot. Ben Porat Yosef, Ben Porat Aleayin. He's a son that's blessed like a grapevine. Girls were dancing on the top of the walls to see him when he became king. They tried to make him bitter, and yet he multiplied. They hated him, those that carried the arrows and tried to shoot him, his own brothers. He contained himself when he was with his master's wife, and may he be blessed by God. And Yaakov goes on to bless him, blessings from the heavens, blessings from the earth, very similar to the blessings Yaakov himself got. Yaakov goes on to tell Yosef, he says, your blessings are greater than the blessings I got. Your blessings go to the edge of the world. You, Yosef, will have all these blessings. You are Nizir Echav, the one among his brothers who is crowned, the one who is separated from the brothers. Binyamin is compared to a wolf. A wolf every day has to hunt and gather what it needs for that day. And so too, Binyamin's tribe, ultimately, the king that they established, King Saul, only lasts for a short period. His dynasty does not continue. Yaakov finishes his blessings. He tells him, I'm going to die. Do me a favor. Bury me back in that grave which I purchased in the land of Israel, in Maaseh Machpelah. That's where Abraham buried his wife. That's where Isaac and his wife were buried. That's where Abraham and his wife were buried. That's where Yitzchak and his wife were buried. That's where I buried Leah. I have here the rights of ownership. And bury me there as well. He finishes telling them what he wants. He picks up his feet, lies on the bed, and passes away. Seems like a nice way to go. He could speak to his children and then passes away. When he passes away, Yosef falls on his father, cries, and kisses him. Why does he have to kiss him? So we'll discuss this when we review it. Yosef commands his servants, the doctors, he tells them, I want you to mummify my father. And they do that. After 40 days, they cry him, they cry over him for another 30 days, a total of 70 days. And Yosef says, I have to take my father up to the land of Israel, as I promised. And Pharaoh tells him, okay, keep your promise. And they go up. And historically, it's recorded that during this journey, there were wars. It wasn't a peaceful journey. Yosef takes a lot of men with him, and he needs them. He's attacked along the way. And they go back up to the land of Canaan. And en route, suddenly, they mourn. You could understand that they'll mourn 7 days when Yaakov passes away. You could understand that they'll mourn 7 days after he's buried. That's the halacha, that you mourn a person after he's buried. But here they do neither. after 70 days that all of Egypt has spent mourning over this great prophet, over Yaakov's death, now suddenly en route to the land of Canaan, they mourn for 7 days. That's something that needs expansion. They bring him to the land of Canaan, they bury him there in the Maror HaMachpelah. Yosef returns to Egypt, and his brothers get scared. His brothers come and they say, wow, maybe now Yosef will get back at us for everything we did to him. And they come to Yosef and they lie. And they say, they make up a story, they say, you should know your father told us that we should tell Yosef, please forgive your brothers for what they did. Please, we beg you, forgive us. And when they tell this to Yosef, he cries. They fall before him, they tell him, we are your servants. And Yosef tells him, don't fear, what? Of course I'm a God-fearing person, I won't harm you. You thought to do me bad, but really God thought that everything would turn out well. I'll sustain you and your children. And here we see that the famine returned. When Yaakov passed away, the famine returned, and that's why they needed this promise from Yosef that he'll sustain them. And then everyone passes away. Yosef and the tribe pass away, and the book of Bereishis ends with Yosef telling his brothers, I am passing away, and God will redeem you and take you back to the land of Israel. And he makes them promise, take my bones out of here. The book of Bereishis ends with Yosef's passing. We have seen for the last few parashiyos that the focus has been on Yosef. That's something to think about. And now we'll review our parasha with more depth. Yaakov is 147 years old when he passes away. Yaakov is 130 years old when he comes to Egypt. We could do the simple math of knowing that Yaakov was in Egypt 17 years. And yet the pasuk tells us Yaakov lived in Egypt 17 years. Why does the pasuk have to tell us that? We say Yosef is a tzaddik. What does it mean to be a tzaddik? We know that the letter tzaddi is one of the letters in the alphabet, right? There's the letter tzaddik. And because Yosef is called a tzaddik and Binyamin is called a tzaddik, the letter tzaddik is representative of Rachel's family. Rachel's family, they have the letter tzaddik and her two children, and we'll see it continues. Rachel's offsprings are tzaddikim. What does it mean to be a tzaddik? We've discussed in the past that the term tzaddik comes from the word tzedek, doing what's right, doing the letter of the law. And sometimes we underestimate the letter of the law. It's true, there's chesed going beyond, but there's the strength of chesed and there's the strength of tzedek. As we had seen in Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, there are two good paths in this world. There are two good ways that a person can behave. One is tzedek and one is chesed. Another term for tzedek is sometimes emet, truthfulness. Yosef, when he left his father's house, was 17 years old. His father had supported him for 17 years. And now the pasuk is pointing out to us that Yaakov lived in Egypt 17 years. For 17 years, Yosef supported his father, supported his whole family. He paid back his father. That's Yosef HaTzadik. The letter of the law. That's what he got, that's what he pays back. We'll see that he did more than that. He sustained his brothers. That's what we saw. He sustained them beyond the 17 years. But for his father, he paid back his father what his father had given him. Yosef caused his father to come down to Egypt. Yosef's the one that's going to take him back and bury him in the land of Israel. And now Yaakov, at the end of 17 years, Yaakov sees the way of the world. Person's walking in the marketplace. He sneezes. He dies. And Yaakov turns to God and he says, God, I don't want to go that way. I want you to give me fair warning before it's my time to go. So Yaakov prays to God and he says, give me a warning sign. We know that the world evolved. We know that initially people didn't age. They would look the same when they were 100 as when they were 20. And Avraham was a little bit bothered by this. He said, God, I walk into the room, everyone stands up. My son Yitzhak, who's 20, walks into the room, everyone stands up. Do me a favor, make something different. And that's why Avram is the first one recorded in Tanakh that he aged, because Avram prayed to God. He said, please introduce this concept to the world, make some difference that people can recognize who's me and who's my son. So God said, good idea, I'll start with you. And Avram is the first person accorded to be zaken, to look old. Yaakov prayed to God, he said, let people have a sign that their end is coming near. So God said, good idea, I'll start with you. So Yaakov starts getting weak as he gets older, he starts getting ill. That's why in every language, when a person sneezes, they say, God bless you, some term like that. The ancient custom used to be that when a person himself sneezed, he would thank God. He would say, thank you, God. Thank you for leaving me alive. Because the world recognized that at this period, something changed. Until this point, people would sneeze and die. And from this period and on, they were given sickness. So Yaakov gets his wish. He's getting weak. He's getting old. There's a story about the Gra that he hadn't seen his sister for many years, and she once traveled in to visit him. And she came in, so they called him out of his study. They said, your sister's here. So he walked in. He asked her, how are you? She said, okay. How's the family? They spoke for 2 or 3 minutes. He said, okay, I wish you all the best. He said, blessing you and your family. And he started turning around to go back to his study. And she yelled. She said, I traveled this whole distance, and after all that, you're only going to talk to me for a few minutes and go back to your learning? So he turned to her and he grabbed his beard. And he said, you see all these white hairs? This is the last reminder God is sending me that I'm on my way up there. I don't have time. And he went back to his study. So Yaakov also gets a warning sign. Yaakov is the beginning of this warning sign. Yaakov gets weaker, he's getting old, and he's going to get sick. He calls Yosef and he tells him, I want you to promise me that you will not bury me in Egypt, you will bury me in Israel. Yaakov has two interests. One, not to be buried in Egypt, because he knows if he's buried in Egypt, they'll make him into an idol. He's a prophet in their midst, they all value him, he doesn't want that. Number two, he says, I want you to take me to the land of Israel and bury me where I belong. Why is he asking Yosef? Simple understanding is, Yosef is the one who can do it. He's the king here. He's second to the king. Another possible understanding is he's saying, it's your fault because you come down here, so you've got to take me back up. Yaakov makes Yosef promise. Now, let's begin simply. God creates the world and gives 7 Noahide laws. Can't serve idols, can't curse God, they have to have a legal system, they can't steal. We have 7 Noahide laws. Where among those laws does it say you have to keep your promise? Yaakov tells him, I want you to promise. And Yaakov isn't the first person to tell someone else, I want you to promise. Abraham told his servant also, promise me you'll bring me the right girl for my son according to the criterion I give you. Well, what good is the promise? If the guy isn't going to keep his word, what do you gain from a promise? So, on one level we could say, well, social norm. In those days they valued a promise. If you just lie, you're a liar. If you break your word after a promise, then you're a dirty liar. Okay? But maybe there's more depth. When one takes a vow, he's swearing by God's name, he's taking an oath that he'll do something. What happens when he breaks that oath? He's showing, I don't value God's name. So it's possible that the reason that vows had power in those days is because it was an extension of the concept that you may not curse God's name. Because if you take a vow and you're saying, I swear by God's name I will do X, Y, and Z, and then you don't do it, you're basically saying God's name could go down the tube. So that's one understanding why the vow was worth something. Yaakov tells Yosef, I want you to take me back and bury me there. And Yosef promises. Why does he have to promise? So Yaakov had a hunch that Paro might not want to let Yosef do this. Paro's going to say, what do you mean? You're running the country. You're going to leave now? you leave, you know what potential there is to assassinate you? You know what can happen to the country, to the economy? We can't afford to let you leave now and make this whole journey up to Canaan. Yaakov has a hunch that Paro doesn't want to agree to this. So Yaakov makes him take a vow. And in truth, we find that when Paro does agree, the pasuk stresses that Paro tells Yosef, okay, go bury your father like he made you promise. And our sages point out that had Yaakov not made Yosef promise, Paro wouldn't have agreed. The Medrash says that Paro initially said no. And Yosef said, but I promise. And Paro said, so? Yosef said, well, I promised to you that I won't reveal the fact that I know more languages than you, and really I should sit on the throne. And Paro said, you're right, you should keep your promises, go bury your father. However you want to cut it, at the end of the day, it is this vow that allows Yosef to go and bury his father. So Yosef takes the vow, and after he takes the vow, Yaakov bows towards the head of the bed. He's bowing in thanks, he's bowing towards God, as we know that God supports a sick person, Hashem yis'adenu al eretz tevai. When a person is ill, Hashem is there supporting him, the pasuk says in Tehillim. That's why halachically, when you visit a sick person, you could pray right then and there. People say, I'll go to shul and pray for you. Now Allah says, pray over there, you have the sinner right there. Allah says you shouldn't position yourself higher than the sick person's head, because the Shekhinah is above his head supporting the sick person. Yosef gets word that his father is ill. He takes his two sons, Menashe and Ephraim, and Yaakov gets word that Yosef is coming. Yaakov sits up. He puts his feet down at the side of the bed. Why does Yaakov have to do this? One understanding is respect. The king's coming. But there's a deeper understanding. We have a halacha of matanat shchiv mera. Shchiv mera is a person that's deathly ill. If you walk into a person who's deathly ill and he says, son, I want to give you all of my estate. I'm giving you all my wealth. I don't want your brother to have any of it. After what he's done, you know, I don't like the wife he married. I don't like the job he took. I told him to go to college. He didn't listen to me. He's not getting a penny. I'm signing it all off over to you. As of this moment, you own all of my estate. Okay, the son gets this, goes to the bank, starts pulling out all the money, goes to the real estate agent, puts up the house for sale, and then father gets better. Or this person gets better. Well, it doesn't have to be a father, it could be any other person. So the halacha says that there are cases where if the person gets better, we say, you know, he only gave you that gift because he thought he was about to die. And therefore, halachically, we say that gift is not valid. So Yaakov sits up on the bed. He's showing, I'm not down and out yet. I'm not a schiv mira. I'm not in the position where my gifts are pending to see what happens with me. No, I'm fully there. I'm fully focused. I still have enough strength to sit up on the bed. Here I am. Now let's talk. We say that if this sick person got up and walked around after being in bed, then that's a sign that he was well enough, that he knew what he was doing, and the gift is a gift. But if not, if he stayed in bed and he was sick, and then he got better, so then there are going to be cases where the gift is null and void. We say the guy only did it because he thought he was going to die. So Yaakov sits up on the bed, he shows, I'm still here, I'm with it. Yaakov can't see anymore. And they tell him, you know, your son Yosef has come. Yaakov sits up and he tells Yosef, you know, God promised me the land of Israel. And your two children, Ephraim and Menashe, I'm going to make them like two tribes. The children you have afterwards, they'll have to fit in with that family. They don't get that status. But these two are going to be considered like two tribes. And when I came back from Padan Aram, I was coming back to the land of Israel, and when I was en route, so your mother, Rachel, passed away on me. And she passed away during childbirth. So I buried her then and there in the land of Israel, and the way up to Ephrat, to Beit Lechem. And I hope you don't hold that against me. I'm asking you to take me up to the land of Israel and bury me, and I couldn't take your mother half a day's journey to bury her in the land of Israel, in the proper burial spot in Maras HaMachpelah. Look, I didn't have a choice. Why didn't I have a choice? Well, simple understanding is the poor woman bled to death, or she died at childbirth. There were complications. You start carrying a woman like that, you start carrying the body, even a half a day's journey, the body's going to bleed so much, you're disgracing the body. We have halacha in general that out of respect for women, we don't detain their body. We take the corpse and try to bury it sooner rather than later, because there are bodily fluids that come out, and by women there are other bodily fluids that will come out, and it's a disgrace for a woman to have her body lying there and you start carrying it around. In general, we rush to bury a person. What they did now, the former president in the United States, the guy died, and everyone's discussing that they'll have funeral processions in a while. That doesn't work in halacha. In halacha, we bury a person as soon as possible. The American media was discussing it by Rabin, that he died, and then 24 hours, 48 hours, he was buried, which is unusual. In the United States, things take a long time, because they don't have any reason to rush to bury a person. In Judaism, we rush to bury a person. And a woman, we rush even more, because we don't want the body to be disgraced. And Rachel, who died during childbirth, so there was all the more reason to rush in burying her. But there was more to it than that. By burying her there, Rachel ended up being buried in the portion that belonged to her children, in Binyamin's territory. By burying her there, Yaakov ensured that future generations, hundreds of years later, when the first temple would be destroyed, and the Jews were being led out of the land of Israel, and in heaven, there was a lot of anger at the Jewish people, and nothing could be done to save them. Every one of the patriarchs' soul came up to heaven and said, God, forgive them, and God said no. The Torah came and said, God, forgive them, and God said no. Moshe Rabbeinu came and said, God, forgive them, and God said no. Aaron came and God said no. Every leader that led the Jewish people, God had an answer to and said, why should I forgive them? Look at how they're sinning. And finally, when everything seemed finished, a voice was heard, a gentle voice was heard, and that was Rachel's voice. When the Jews were being led out of the land of Israel to exile, they passed by Kever Rachel. And the Jews stopped at the grave and started praying and crying to Rachel and saying, go up in heaven, talk to God, talk on our behalf. And when they did that, they were able to arouse Rachel's soul, and Rachel went before God, and Rachel said, so they sinned. So they brought idols into the temple. So they worshipped the sun and bowed to the sun in the morning and had their backs to the Holy of Holies. So it's like a person taking another wife. And that's painful. But if I could take my sister, who was my major competition throughout life, and stick her in and tell her, you go marry him. I didn't tell her go marry him, but when she was up to be married, bottom line, I could have stopped it. I could have not told her the secret sign that I had made up with Yaakov. If I would have kept quiet, then she would have been heavily embarrassed there under the chuppah. Yaakov would have recognized it's not her. Instead, I gave her the sign so that when she showed up under the chuppah, Yaakov was waiting for her to give him the sign that it's me. And when she got those signs, she married him. And I brought in another wife into the house. Well, if I could do that, then God, you could live with them serving idols in the temple. And when Rachel said that, there was no answer. That's when in heaven the tide changed. So Yaakov foresaw that, and Yaakov wanted Rachel buried there so that the Jews would pass by her. There's another understanding. Yaakov had just left Laban's house. And in Rud, Yaakov was very scared of his brother Esau. If you recall, Yaakov prepared. He thought Esau was going to come and wipe out, potentially, half the camp. And then Esau makes up with him, and Esau stays living in the land of Israel. And Yaakov remains for a year and a half in the land of Israel, encountering the troubles with Dinah and Shechem, etc. And then they're traveling, and Rachel dies. Now, Yaakov wanted to have rights to the Maris HaMachpelah. One understanding is that when he purchased the rights to the firstborn from Esau, he also purchased the rights to the Maris HaMachpelah. But there's another understanding. The simple understanding is that at this point, it was unclear who would have the rights to the Maris HaMachpelah. There were two spots left to be buried. And Esav could claim, I want one of them. Now for Rachel to be buried next to Esav is not a great honor. So the issue wasn't settled yet. Only after Rachel passes away does Esav pack his bags and leave to the land of Seir and tell Yaakov, Jacob, you could have the land of Israel. I have no interest in it. I'm taking the mountains of Seir. I'm taking my portion. You want to have the curse of being down in Egypt or having your offsprings in servitude for 400 years? You can have it. I want to have nothing to do with it. Only after Rachel passes away. And that's why when later that year Leah passes away, Leah can be buried in Maaret HaMachpelah, because by that point Esav had left. But when Rachel passed away, that's what Yaakov stresses. I had just come into the land. I was fresh here. Rachel passed away. I had all the kids to take care of, all the cattle to take care of, and I didn't have clear rights to that cave. So I couldn't really bury her there. So he's apologizing. However you cut it, he's apologizing to Yosef that he didn't bury his mother where Yosef would want to. He buried Leah in that cave, and now he's telling Yosef, bury me next to Leah. Take me up there. He doesn't tell Yosef, bury me next to your mother. He's saying, no, bury me in the Maaret HaMachpelah, where my father is, my grandfather is, and your stepmother, Leah, not next to your mother. So he has to apologize. He has to explain what's going on. He explains. Yaakov is now close to passing away. When a person is close to passing away, if he's on a high enough level, he knows it. And Yaakov is on the level of Ruach HaKodesh for the last 17 years, since he reunited with Yosef. And he looks, he can't see Yosef's children, but when he looks at them, he feels the Shekhinah departing. He foresees that they're going to have offsprings that are not fitting. And he says, who are these guys? And Yosef says, they're my children. Now, from the time Yosef had left his father to when they were reunited, 21 years had passed. And when Yosef left his father, he was a little bit too busy with his looks. He was taking care of his curls, he was taking care of his locks. Whatever that means, however we understand this, our sages point out that he was behaving like a 17-year-old, interested in looking good. And when they reunite 21 years later, Yosef wants to kiss his father, and his father refuses. And they spend the next 17 years together in Egypt, and whenever Yosef wants to kiss his father shies away. Why? Because his father suspects, he says, 21 years this man was in the most immoral country, the country which is known for having improper relationships between men and men, women and women, men and women. When the Torah wants to say that a woman shouldn't go with another woman, the Torah says, don't do like the Egyptians do. Torah doesn't specify what it's talking about. We have a tradition. The Torah is talking about women going with women. So Yaakov says 21 years he's been in this country, and it's possible that he had an improper relationship. Well, I don't want those lips to kiss me. So as fond as he is of Yosef, he doesn't let Yosef kiss him. And now Yosef brings his children before him, and when Yaakov sees them, he feels the Shekhinah leaving him. He says, who are these guys? Where did they come from? And Yosef automatically says, no. I married a Jewish girl. I married a girl, my niece, really, that was sent down here after the whole story of Shechem and Dinah. And I could show you here. Here's the contract. This is proper. I'm okay. Okay. I guess he believed Yosef. And Yosef starts praying to God that God should come back. and God answers his prayer. And then Yaakov tells Yosef, okay, bring them close, I want to bless them. When Yosef brings them forward, Yaakov first kisses them and hugs them. On a simple level, this shows the importance of showing affection. People sometimes think that if I'm important, if I'm high up there, if I'm a rabbi, if I'm the higher I am, the less appropriate it is to show affection. Well, certain affection is improper to be shown in public, but affection is important to be shown. The halacha says you're not supposed to kiss someone in shul. In shul, the proper thing is that we save our affection. This is a place where we show we're connected to God. You can understand by inference that outside shul, it's understandable, it's expected that a person does kiss his children, does hug them. So Yaakov hugs and kisses his grandchildren, and he tells Yosef, you know, I never expected to see you. Ve'ofanecha lo filalti. And here we have the root of the word filah. And the word filalti can be understood, I never judged, I never thought that I'd be able to see you. Another understanding is, I never even prayed for it. I was sure you were dead. And this shows us something. There are times that we get things that we didn't even think we could pray for. Yaakov tells Yosef, you know, I didn't even pray to see you. I thought it was all over. And I've seen you and your children. And this is a point we spoke a lot about last week, that things aren't always what they seem. But the whole story of Yosef's brother standing up to Yosef and they don't know how things are going to work out, well, here we have another example of that. Yaakov had already given up. The Kutzker Rebbe used to say there's a Gemara that discusses Yish Shalom Midas. If a person loses an object, then he doesn't know he lost it. A person drops the key at Yankee Stadium, and he doesn't know he dropped the key. So we say, if he would have known, he would have lost hope. What are the chances that he'll ever get that key back? But he doesn't know he lost it. So do we say that halachically we consider it as though he already gave up hope and you could hold on to that key? So that's called Yish Shalom Midas, giving up hope when you don't even know about it. Do we consider it that the guy gave up hope, or we say that he didn't know about it, so it's still in his possession? Halachically, the second a person gives up hope, then he's given up ownership. Meaning, if a person loses 100 shekels, and he says, okay, that's it, I lost it, what can I do? I'm never going to see those 100 shekels again. He's given up on those 100 shekels. When someone else finds them, they belong to that person, because the person has given up ownership and giving up hope of ever retaining them. So the Kutzker Rebbe used to say, Yush, giving up hope is Shalom Midas. That's always done out of lack of knowledge. No such thing as giving up hope when you're with it. If you're with it, you don't give up hope. And Yaakov over here is testifying, you know, I didn't even pray to see you again. I thought it was all over. And Yosef takes his children and brings them to his father. And when they approach Yaakov, so Yaakov doesn't want to shame the older one. He doesn't want the older one to recognize that he's less, even though he's older. So above their heads, he crosses his hands, so they don't see that the right hand went on the younger one. What's the idea of putting one's hand on someone in order to bless them? So this concept is the concept of smicha. When Moshe is told to give over the leadership and Torah authority to Yoshua, so God tells him, place your hand on Yoshua, and he will be a continuum for you. You tell him that's it, you're next, you're running the show. And from there the concept of smicha evolved, that every rabbi that wants to ordain another rabbi, we say he gives him smicha. Now there are two opinions about what happened in future generations. The Rambam says that it was only Moshe who physically placed his hands on the next rabbi. It was only Moshe who physically placed his hands on Yoshua. But other Rishonim learned that no, historically, every time a rabbi was ordained, the rabbis who ordained him would place their hands on him, just as Moshe had done to Yoshua. When Kohanim come to bless the people, so really they should put their hands on each person's head. But they can't, You could have one kohen blessing a crowd of 5,000 people or more. So what they do is they pick up their hands. And in picking up their hands, it's as though they're putting their hands on everyone's head. That's why the Sephardim have the custom that the father puts his hand on the child's head, or an older brother, while the person is getting the blessing from the kohanim. The idea is that when we place our hands on something, we want the blessing, so to speak, to come from our hands to the person. And it seems to me like we could understand this based on a medrash. The medrash says that there are two britot, there are two covenants that God made with the Jewish people. There's the brit that we all know, what we call brit milah, and that is placed in between the 10 fingers of the feet. You have five fingers on each foot, and in between the feet you have one brit. And then you have another brit, the Medrash says, between the 10 fingers of the hands. Meaning you have 5 fingers on each hand, and in between you have the mouth. And that covenant is the covenant of learning Torah. You have the two hands, and in between you have the mouth, and God made a covenant with us that we should learn Torah. So it could be that when a person is saying the blessing with his mouth, so the mouth is described as something that's in between the two hands in this medrash. And it could be that the blessing will go through the hand, so to speak, and that's why the person places his hand on the person as he's blessing him with the mouth. When Yaakov comes to bless his sons, he says, God, who my forefathers were before, who was, so to speak, my best friend, ha-ho-e-oti, he was my close friend, he always sustained me from the time I was nothing till now, the angel that always rescued me should bless the children. He's asking an angel to bless. Seems to be against one of the Gimelik Karim, right? One of the 13 principles of Jewish faith is that we don't talk to intermediaries. What's going on here? Before we address that, we have to ask ourselves another question. Every Friday night, we say, Shalom Aleichem, welcome to the angels of Shabbos. Baruchuni v'shalom, bless me for peace, Malachi HaShalom, you angels of peace. The angels should bless me? I thought one of the 13 principles of faith are that we don't ask angels for blessings. Yeah. Huh? Right? Some omit that. Sometimes those people who omit it have guests who say, you skipped something. What? Okay. Right, you see? That's usually what happens. When we say slichos, when we have the days of atonement before Rosh Hashanah and then between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, so towards the end of slichos we say machnisei rachamim, those that bring in the mercy before God, please bring in our prayers. How could you ask angels to bring in prayers? So those are three examples, and there are more, of situations where we do seem to talk to angels about prayers. So the truth is that sometimes God is referred to as a malach, as funny as that may seem. And a simple understanding in our parsha is that he's blessing Yosef and he's saying, God, who my forefathers walked before, who always protected me, Hamalach HaGoeloti, he always sent that angel. That Hamalach doesn't mean the angel should do the blessing, but rather through an angel, he always saves me, and he should bless, which is how Rav Saadia Gaon, among others, translates this pasuk. Not that the angel should do the blessing, but rather through an angel, he always saves me, and he, God, should bless. Doesn't seem to be the way Rashi is learning. Doesn't seem to be the way the Targum Unculus is learning, and others. So that opens the question, when can we speak to angels about blessing us? And here there are different opinions among the Rishonim, how you break this down. The Kabbalists extended what would seem permissible as far as talking to angels. And historically, there were great arguments about whether you could say these prayers, these blessings that we're saying now, the examples we quoted. There were those who were very strongly opposed to saying this. Yaakov blesses Yosef that his offsprings should be like fish, they should multiply like fish. And this has numerous interpretations. Either fish give birth to many children at a time, female fish lays many eggs at a time, or fish are covered by the water, and we have a tradition that the Ein Hara can't touch them, so to Yosef's offspring, Ein Hara can't touch. Yaakov tells Yosef, the Jewish people should bless their children through you. They should say, Yisimcha Elokim Kefraim v'Menashe. That's how Jews bless. God should make you like Ephraim and Menashe. What's so special about Ephraim and Menashe? So some want to say that they're the first Jews who made it in exile. They're the example of a Jew who grew up in exile and made it, and was obedient, followed the ways of the Torah. Okay. Yaakov tells Yosef, I'm giving you an extra portion, I'm giving you Shechem. It's interesting, if there's one place Yosef should hate, it should be Shechem. That's where he was sold from. Shechem isn't something that should bring back fond memories to Yosef. But that's where he was buried. Right. He was sold from Shechem, and he was buried from Shechem. So one understanding says that Yaakov didn't give him the whole city of Shechem. Yaakov told him, I'm giving you an extra portion. That extra portion is that I'm making your children two tribes. And I'm giving you that little plot of land in Shechem, you'll be buried back in Shechem. Yaakov calls his children together and he says, gather, I want to tell you what's going to be. Gather and listen, the sons of Yaakov, listen to your father. Why does he tell them to gather twice? Because there were only two times that the Jewish people were fully gathered. When we were redeemed from Egypt, you had all 12 tribes gathering. And only in the future redemption, the redemption that Mashiach is going to bring, will we have the Jewish people regrouping. Because when we came back from the first exile, we didn't have all 12 tribes coming together. Most of the Jews didn't even come to the land of Israel. Most of the Jews said, it's good in Chutzlars, why should we come? Ezra came with a minority. Ezra came with the people that he could threaten. He said, if you don't come, A, B, C, and D, I'll harm you. Whoever Ezra could threaten, he managed to bring with him. There were very few who came of their own accord. So Yaakov is alluding to two things, to the period in Egypt and the period that will be. Yaakov says, I want to tell you what's going to be at the end of time. And Yaakov does not tell them what will be at the end of time. When Yaakov wants to bless his children, he says, in all my children's names, we don't have the letter Chet and we don't have the letter Tet. Those two letters don't appear in their name. Must be there's no chet among my children. So I could tell them the case, when the end of time will be. And then Yaakov realizes that there's no kuf and there's no tzadi in their name either. So they're not fitting to hear about the case, when the end of time would be. Kuf, tzadi, spell the word case. Yeah. Okay. I don't know.
Is it a question in that part of the song? Like we're saying, who is the king?
Not who is the king. We're saying they are the angels from the king. Mi melech. It's one word. Ketz is kuf tzadi. Our parsha is unusual. Ordinarily, there's a break, a line, a space in the Sefer Torah before parsha begins. Our parsha doesn't have that space. And there are two understandings as to why that is so. One is that Yaakov wanted to reveal when we would end this whole period of Galus, when the Messiah would come, and it was closed off. God didn't allow him to reveal it. And that's why the parsha is closed off. You could barely tell where the parsha begins. Another understanding is that the period of servitude began in our parsha, when the Jews want to go up to bury their father, and suddenly Pharaoh says, no, you guys leave your kids here, leave your wealth here. Pharaoh doesn't want to let Yosef go. They suddenly realize, hey, we no longer have sovereignty. We can't leave and come when we wish. We can't leave when we wish. So suddenly they realize they're stuck in Egypt, and their hearts, their eyes, their hope started dwindling, and that's why the parasha is sealed off. There's a pasuk in the Navi Yeshaya that says, "Lemarbe hamisra ulshalom en ketz." When the Jewish people will attain the great stature that they deserve, "Lemarbe hamisra," like Sarah, "ulshalom en ketz," and when peace will have no limit, the prophet is describing that period of time when the end of time will come. And there's something unusual about that pasuk. Ordinarily, we know that when you have the letter mem in the middle of a word, it's an open mem. You have a mem with a little crack on the bottom left. When you have a mem at the end of the word, it's like a closed box. And in that word, limnarbe, the mem is not at the end of the word, and yet traditionally that is a closed mem. It's the only place in Tanakh where you have a closed mem in the middle of a word. Limarbe hamisra. And there's another pasuk in Ezra, Nehemiah actually, where you have mem at the end of the word, when they describe the walls of Jerusalem that are shattered, that they have breaches and have been consumed by fire. The pasuk says, "Bechomot Yerushalayim asher hem peruzim," the walls of Jerusalem that are breached. And the word hem, the mem is at the end of the word. And in spite of the fact that it's at the end of the word, we have a tradition that that mem is an open mem, as though it were the middle of the word. Those are the two exceptions we have on tradition in Tanakh. It's not a mem sufi, correct. Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 13, Nehemiah Beis Yud Gimel. And the first one is in Yeshaya, Perek Tes, Pasuk Vav.
The first one is Limar.
Limarbe hamisra. When there'll be a lot, like Rav. Marbe, harbe, yeah. So, when we have that mem sealed off, limarbe hamisra ulshalom en ketz, that is alluding to this concept. That the period when the Jews will retain their stature, that's sealed off, like that mem is sealed off. It's closed off. And when will that happen? Ezra describes the walls of Jerusalem asher hem peruzim, and this pasuk is referring to the period of Golus, the period where the walls of Jerusalem will remain breached throughout the time that we are exiled, and that's why the mem at the end of the word is breached. When that breach that shouldn't be there, in the pasuk of Ezra, the breach in the walls, just as the breach in that mem is sealed, when the walls of Jerusalem will be sealed, that's when the mem in Hamisra will be open, that's when the word will be written correctly, that the Jewish people will retain their stature. That's what the Medrash says. So, when Daniel wants to tell the people when the Messiah is going to come, the angel shows up to Daniel and tells him, no, hide it. No one's supposed to figure out when it'll be. A lot of wise people will try to figure out, and they won't get it right. And we find historically that many people tried. The Sadia Gaon, the Rambam, Rashi, and their dates have passed. And as Rashi writes in Daniel, when the date passes, then we know that the person who tried to figure it out erred, and we have to look at the Pesukim again and figure out what the right shot is. But the angel already told Daniel that many people will try and they will err. So the time is supposed to be hidden. Yaakov knew when it was, but he couldn't tell his children. By the way, the Maharal, among others, say that every explanation that our sages gave in those psukim was correct. But there were many potential explanations. And every time when that period came, there was potential for the Jews to be redeemed. But the Jews hit the snooze button. They said, no, we're not ready yet. So you have to learn a new explanation, and that explanation also has potential if we'll live up to it. Yeah? At every time Mashiach can come. That's a concept we have to discuss, that what's the Geula and what's the Mashiach.
Whether we as a nation are ready
come at any time. Yeah, there's no time that Mashiach cannot come other than Friday.
Really?
The Gemara says it's not going to show up on Friday. We have to keep Shabbos. But we have to discuss, there's a concept of Mashiach and Geula. We say Benisan Nigalu of Nisan Asidin Nigael. In Nisan they were redeemed, in Nisan they will be redeemed. So there's a concept of Geula, and there's a concept of Mashiach, and there are many concepts which all have to be discussed, but that's not our class today. At any rate, Yaakov kept it hidden. I think not. I don't remember. We have to look it up in the Gemara, where the Gemara says it. Yaakov calls his children together. He begins by telling them, I want to tell you what's going to be at the end of time. And the end of time, he doesn't tell them. So one understanding is that God hid it from him. The other understanding is he didn't really mean the end of time. He meant what's going to be at the end of this exile, at the end of this period in Egypt. And that he does tell them. He begins by rebuking. And there's an interesting medrash that says that Yaakov waited till the end of his days to rebuke, because he said if I rebuke them earlier, they might rebel and leave. Reuven might go and join forces with Esau. So you ask yourself, Reuven, the tzaddik, Reuven, who began the concept of tshuva in the world, Reuven, he's worried he's going to leave and go to Esau. So the simple understanding is, yes, anytime you rebuke a person, you're hurting him and you're distancing him. The word hocheach, tochacha, to rebuke, comes from the word vikuach, to argue. You're fighting with someone. No one wants to hear their rule. And you never know where it's going to lead. So a person always has to weigh what's for the other person's benefit and how to go about doing it. So our sages always waited till the end of their days to give rebuke. And that's it. They won't have to repeat it if the guy keeps messing up, because that's the way most people do. They keep going the way they've been going until now. Except for in Machon Meir. You guys think I'm joking? I'm not. The mere fact that people walk into Machon Meir already shows they're taking a change of course in their life. But most people, believe it or not, have a very hard time changing anything in their life. So Reuven, he says, you know, you are my strength. Veshitoni, you are my first strength. Our sages say that Yaakov never emitted sperm in vain. The first time was when he had Reuven. And this is an exceptional trait of Yaakov. We say that a person is forbidden to emit sperm in vain, but the average person is going to have it happen once a year, twice a year. It's normal that it happens. A person is not allowed to cause it to happen. It's biblically prohibited to have even a thought during the day, an improper thought, because we say that can lead a person to having a wet dream at night. But we see that it is considered normal, that this is considered a great level of piety on behalf of Yaakov Avinu, that he could say, Reuven, you were the beginning of my strength. You had potential to have a double portion in the land of Israel, the kingship and kahuna, and you lost all three. Why? Because you were quick to anger, you acted quickly. Most of life's errors are done in haste. Something to remember, Reuven lost everything. He remained part of the 12 tribes, but he lost the holiness that his tribe was supposed to attain. He lost the rights to the kingship, and he lost the double portion. And as much as he tried to do tshuva, he could never regain that. There's a saying in Hebrew that says, haste is from the devil. Whenever we could, it pays not to. It's something to think about when we're driving also. There's a reason why there's a speed limit. In everything in life, a person should really stop and think before he does things. I was once sitting at a lunchroom table, and a guy next to me started telling the story of the woman he hit when he was driving. And I could never forget that conversation. You could hear how sad the person was that he was driving beyond the speed limit, and how guilty he felt years later because he ruined this woman's life and her family's life. And he can never replace what he had done. When we speed, we have to know that we're not only speeding and driving and everything we do. When people stand at a crosswalk here in Israel, people get killed every day. And a person could look both ways and say, yeah, I know I shouldn't cross, but I see that no cars are coming. So you should know that when you start crossing, the kid standing next to you is instinctively going to start crossing too. And you're giving him a sign, you're telling him, don't worry about the fact that it says don't cross. So A, he may start crossing and not make it to the other end, because he's not going to go at your pace. B, next time he comes to a do not cross sign, he might just cross. And C, what very often happens, and I've seen this many times, is that you stand on one side, and you have a do not cross. You start crossing. There's an old lady standing on the other side. She sees you starting to walk, she starts to walk. Instinctively. And I've seen more than once that people almost got run over, because for you there was no car coming, but for her there is. So, the question is, what do we gain when we rush, and what do we risk losing? And it's worth remembering that our intent has a lot to do with it. If a person stands at a do not cross sign and says, I'm not going to cross because I have to be in the habit of not crossing when it's red, because it could harm someone's life if I do. So he's doing a mitzvah at that minute. He's going to get reward in the world to come, because he's containing himself to do the right thing. It's worth remembering. People get killed. Shimon and Levi are spoken to as one. And there's a misconception. People think that Yaakov's coming to bless his children here. It's not right. Yaakov's coming to give them his final speech. Part of it is going to be blessing. Reuven doesn't get blessing. Shimon and Levi don't get blessed either. He says, I want to have nothing to do with what they did. And according to some understandings, he's very upset at the fact that they murdered the city of Shechem, which is a different perspective than we built when we learned the parasha. When we learned the parasha, we discussed why halachically what they did was correct. And others say that when he said, "Klei chamas mecherotehem," their food, their sustenance comes with thievery, he's saying they killed the people of Shechem without justice and took their wealth and their food. Shimon and Levi achim, they are united. Shimon and Levi are brothers. They know how to be faithful to the to Dina, but they're not good brothers to Yosef. They're the ones that sold him. Let's see. Reuven is the eldest. He certainly didn't want to sell him. He said, let's save him. Let's throw him into the pit, because he wanted to save him. Who's next in line? Shimon and Levi and Yehuda. Yehuda certainly didn't want to sell him. He's the one that said, we can't have him die. So who's left? Shimon and Levi, they're the ones that wanted him dead. They're the ones that as he was approaching, they sicked vicious dogs against him, they picked up their bows and arrows to kill him. Yaakov Avinu foresees the sins that are coming in their offsprings and says, I don't want my name mentioned when Korach is mentioned, and that's why the Torah does him that favor, that when it mentions Korach, who rebelled against Moshe Rabbeinu, does not mention in his lineage Yaakov. The same thing with Zimri. At the end of the 40 years in our desert, the head of the tribe of Shimon he leads the way with going with the women of Midian. And when the Torah tells us his lineage, the Torah does Yaakov that favor. It omits the fact that he's Yaakov's great-great-grandson. When Yaakov curses them, he curses them with the love of the father. He doesn't curse them, but rather he curses their anger. And he tells them, you have to be scattered. Sometimes the solution is to scatter. And that's why the tribe of Shimon were scattered throughout the tribe of Yehuda. They didn't have their cities next to one another. Their territory is within the territory of the tribe of Yehuda. The tribe of Levi is scattered throughout the land. Yehuda hears all this and he starts stepping back. He's scared. After what he did with Tamar, he thinks his dad's going to give it to him. And he says, no, Yehuda, everyone owes you. You're going to lead the way. You're going to have the kings from you. Everyone should bow to you. You're like a lion. The leadership will remain among the tribe of Yehuda till Shiloh. What does it mean till Shiloh? So here, you should just be aware that there were many claims. They wanted to claim this is a source. That's why they discussed that certain people were born in Shiloh. They want to say all kinds of things. And if you look at the sources, you see that there's not much validity to it. We spend a few minutes, but I don't think it's even worth it. Shiloh is the place where the kingdom was divided. You look in the book of Malachim and Kings, you see that that's where they decided to appoint Yeravam ben Nevat to take away 10 tribes from the tribe of Yehuda. You see that the prophet who said that 10 tribes would leave the Davidic dynasty came from the city of Shiloh. So there are many simple understandings in the Pesukim that discuss the the leadership leaving Yehuda's family, I don't think it's even worth the time. Zevon is given extra blessing. He's the partner of Yisachar, and we have a halachic concept of a Yisachar Zevon deal, and that is that two people can make a deal that we divide the income and we divide the merits in the world to come. We have a tradition that this is what Yisachar and Zevon used to do, and our legal contracts that are brought down in halacha, how a person can do this. And every person has a mitzvah to learn Torah. A businessman, any person has a mitzvah to learn Torah. Historically, many of the great rabbis were businessmen, but historically they had to travel a lot and they didn't have cell phones, and during their travels they were able to learn Torah. Today, you're on the phone all the time, it's almost impossible. It's not impossible, but it's far more difficult to get the learning done that they once upon time were able to get done while being a businessman. So every person's obligated to learn Torah, and if a person can't learn as much as he should, a person can't spend two-thirds of his day learning, so a person should at least support those that learn Torah. That's halacha and Shulchan Aruch. And if he could, you should get into this kind of deal. Yisachar Zevulun. Sometimes people come to me and say, I want to give money to help a guy who's learning. And I say, fine. You want me to find someone? I'll find someone for you. I'll try at least. But what people sometimes don't realize is that this is not a Yisachar Zevulun deal. It's the best kind of charity you could give. I try to find someone who needs it, and they're giving charity to someone who needs the money, and he's learning Torah, so they're supporting learning Torah. But they did not make a contract. They do not have a Yisachar Zevulun deal. What they have is they're giving money to someone who's learning Torah. Very good. It's a good thing to do. It's the proper thing to do. But it's not a Yisachar Zevulun deal. Yisachar Zevulun deal is that we share in the profits and we share in the world to come. A husband and wife do not have a Yisachar Zevulun deal. A husband and wife are considered one entity. They're investing together and they share the profits. Meaning, let's say in the world to come they're going to get, we'll call it 100, whatever, 100 of Eden. So she gets 50 and he gets 50. It's divided equally. Yisachar Zevulun, so their partner, the deal is you give me half the profits and you get that share in the learning. But according to some understandings, the one who's learning doesn't necessarily have to lose. With the wife, he's losing. It's half-half. We both invested. We have to divide the profits. Unless one writes up a contract, Yisachar Zevulun deal, as far as I understand the halacha, that's not what's happening. One is getting the merit, which one should try to get, of supporting someone who's learning Torah. The pasuk says Yisachar is like a donkey. That, yeah.
Is there a discussion about any kind of quantifiable merit in the halacha?
Yes. You could look, what I said now is a summary of a Tshuva Negros Moshe. This difference between Yisachar Zevulun and a husband and wife. It's also discussing Shulchan Aruch. The halachos of Talmud Torah and Shulchan Aruch. There's a discussion over there also of the halachos of Yisachar and Zevulun. It's interesting that throughout Yehuda's blessing, the letter Zayin doesn't appear. Zayin represents Klei Zayin, armor. Yehuda's one that's leading us to war, and yet throughout his blessing, the letter Zayin doesn't appear because Yehuda's wars are fought by the fact that God is with him, not with the armor. Our success is not because we have the best tanks or the F-15 bombers. Our success is because God wants us to succeed. And so Yehuda, who's going to lead us to war throughout his blessing, the letter Zayin doesn't appear. So this comment is mentioned by Rabbeinu Bechaye. Later generations question, how come the letter Tzaddik doesn't appear? That's the only other letter that doesn't appear in Yehuda's blessing. And they answer that the concept of Tzaddik is something that really is Yosef, Rachel's offspring. They get that letter. And its omission, they want to say, is a sign that Yehuda, as great as he is, that's not his strength. We have every other letter in the Jewish alphabet. Rabbeinu Bechaye says every letter but the Zion. And later commentaries add that the Tzadi is also missing, and this is how they explain it. It's interesting that Zevulun is mentioned before Yisachar. And we find this in the Gemara also. There were Amoron who had this deal, and it seems like the one who supports gets more honor than the one who's learning Torah. We would think it's the other way around, and yet it seems to be that he does. Yisachar is compared to a donkey, that a donkey doesn't rest. He, as he's working, he stops along the way and rests over there. He doesn't get to go home and rest. He's compared to a donkey that's chamol garem. Garem is Aramaic for bones, a strong donkey that doesn't have a lot of flesh and has a lot of bones. So to one who wants to purely learn Torah has to purify himself of the physical as much as he could and carry the yoke of Torah. He has to travel to find the rabbi to learn by. And then the next pasuk says, Yisachar saw that it's good to rest. Well, what's going on here? The previous pasuk just said he doesn't get to rest at home. He works all day and all night. When he rests, it's on the road. And now we're saying he saw that it's good to rest. So our sages say that what it means is that in order to learn Torah, a person needs a certain element of calm. A person can't be on the run all the time, busy with 100 things and succeed in learning Torah. It doesn't work. When Yoshua sees that there are prophets who are prophesizing out of Moshe Rabbeinu's authority, Yoshua says, can't be. There's only one leader among the Jewish people. Moshe, we have to bind them down. What do we have to do? Give them the job of being in charge of public funds. Let them be in charge of some charity organization. They'll never be able to succeed in learning Torah that way. When he says, my master Moshe, bind them, what he means is bind them to a public task. If they'll be working with the public, they'll never succeed in Torah. You want to succeed in Torah, you need quiet and to sit down and learn. The Rambam in his Igeres, I think it's Igeres Teiman, or Igeres Tchias HaMeshim, I don't remember, one of his famous letters, he begins by telling them, don't believe everything they say about me. I'm not where my forefathers were, and I'm not where I should be, because I'm so busy I can't. It's impossible. And even though we know how great the Rambam was, but the concept that he's saying is true. He doesn't need me to say it, but someone else who reads it might think the Rambam is just being modest, but it's not so. In order for a person to truly succeed in learning Torah and attain his potential, he needs a certain element of calm. He needs to be able to sit down and delve into the learning. They say that the Gro, when he used to learn, he'd walk into a closed room, close the curtains, have complete darkness and quiet, turn on a candle and learn by the candle. You want to learn, you have to be focused. You need quiet. Yeah?
Rewind question. You're distinguishing the individual that had tzaddik, therefore he wasn't on that level of Yosef and his offspring. But yet, we commonly call all the brothers tzaddikim.
We misuse the term tzaddik. We use it too freely.
I have talked to students in my home about the noise level of the basement versus the shouting that often happens during the period of tomorrow the day that contributes to the noise level. And one of them said that Rabbi Gaon actually said something about how it's supposed to get loud.
I think
it disturbs my learning when I hear people yawn.
So some people can get accustomed to Beit Medrash noise, and some people need quiet. Throughout my high school years, the principal, Rabbi Katzenstein, always used to tell me, you have to get used to the Beit Medrash noise. I always said, I can't focus here. And he said, get used to it. So I learned a good number of hours in Beit Medrash in high school, and a good number of hours in post-high school. And over a decade later, I can tell you I'm still not used to it. I still go to the library to learn. And when people start yelling in the library, I run away and go to a quiet room. Maybe I should have put more effort into getting used to it. But that's why I quoted to you the story of the Gra, because that's my comfort. I don't know if the story is true, but when I heard the story of the Gra, I stopped feeling so bad. For many, many years after high school, I always felt, well, if I can't concentrate on this noise, then there's something wrong with me. Because everyone else, I mean, this is what my high school principal told me. He said, get used to it. That's how the whole world learns. They learn in the noisy base medrash. Get used to the noise, you'll learn to love it. So I do love it, but I still can't focus in the noisy base medrash.
Is there some halacha that says that you shouldn't disturb your neighbor?
There's halacha about prayer. And even there in prayer, we say that if your neighbor has a book in front of him, then it's his responsibility to overcome the noise and focus.
What about those people who clap their hands
in prayer?
Yeah, who clap their hands, express love, and they take an extra long time to finish the response. Yeah, for the Kaddish. Yeah.
That I don't think you could have a claim against. Everyone, we have a concept in halacha that a shul is public domain, and a person is allowed to answer kaddish loudly. Ordinarily, we say with regard to blessings that you're supposed to respond on the same volume that the person who made the blessing used. But when it comes to kaddish, it's not that way. There are sources that say this is a way of showing that you're doing it with all of your strength. And there's a medrash that says that one who enters kaddish with all of his strength, then even if he had 70 years decreed upon him in heaven to have 70 bad years, they'll cut that up, that gezeirah din in heaven. So one opinion says, what does it mean with all your strength? It means to yell, yehei shmei rabo. A person could say, I'm going with that opinion. I don't think you could complain, even though it might bother you, and you might be right that it's bothering you. But shul is public domain.
What about the
I hear your point. I'm not sure who's right in this case. I don't know. I could hear both sides. I don't know. Yeah, but just one point. There is a head to this institution, and Rav Bigun is accessible. Why don't you pose the question to him? He is the one that calls the shots here. He is the Marad Hasra. So makes sense that if you think that your complaint is valid, and it might be, I don't know, pose it to him. What? About learning noisily or about the people during prayer?
Okay, so I guess I can't believe anyone's learning, but the prayer, I think, the prayer, I suppose, is the best thing. Well, I don't know, you feel like it's difficult. You should be watching very carefully before reproving someone. I don't know, my instinct tells me to very politely and respectfully approach a person and ask him, not even necessarily to see him, to do it, just to say, look, this.
I would sooner go to Rav Bigun, because maybe Rav Bigun will tell you that it's not even fair to you of you to make that request. And by making a request, you're asking a person to change something. I'll tell you a story. I think this point is enough. We don't need the story. No, we don't have that much time, and I want to cover more points on the parasha. Yeah. Question is that I think that as far as the learning, so that's what happens in a Beis Medrash. People talk loudly. They're saying that during prayer, people are making extra noise, clapping hands, and that. So that, I don't know. The question has to be posed to Rav Bigun, because you have to remember that people are advancing, and people have to be allowed in Machon Meir certain things, and in other places they wouldn't be allowed. So you could say, well, then we should be allowed to complain, and you could say this person should be allowed to express himself. So I could hear whatever you'll say, but the one who calls the shots is Rav Bigun. So it makes sense that the question should be posed to him. I would not go to the person and say anything to him. I don't think that's fair. By saying something, you're automatically imposing your opinion on him. Now it means that every time he does it, he has to feel bad that he's doing it. And maybe he doesn't have to feel bad. Maybe he's within his rights. That's what I think. I think that Rav Bigun is an understanding person. very understanding person. I would love him. Yeah. Yeah. I think we addressed it in Parshas Yetzer, and Emet Shem will address it again in a few months. If you want, bring it up on a Thursday night, and we'll try to address it there. Okay? No, just say it'll take a few minutes. It's a Medrash. There's a source for it. Yeah. Or if you want, you could look up, the Das Zakenim, if I'm not mistaken, on the Chumash. He quotes it over there when Yisachar is given his name. So that is it. That's Kenim. Yeah.
One of the things we were learning about coming from the brothers is that this is also the importance of diversity and context. So,
okay. It's one of the things we see in the blessing, that each one is given his personal blessing, prophecy. Yisachar sees that he needs, on the one hand, to work very hard and rest very little. On the other hand, Vayal Menucha, he sees that he needs a certain element of Menucha in order to attain the high levels of learning. And that is why in our prayers of Shmon Esrei we say, Hashiva Shofetenu Kevarishona, God, please return our judges the way they once were. Give us back the great rabbis that once existed. V'yotzeinu kevatchila, and our advisors the way they initially were. V'haser mimenu yagon v'anacha, remove from us anxiety and sighing. Why do we add that? What does that have to do with anything? So one understanding is that when a person doesn't have good judges, so then he has a lot of anxiety and sighing. We say, God, give us back the good judges of ancient times. But there's another understanding that says, if we want to attain these people on this high level, the judges where they should be, the advisors where they should be, if we want to have sages like we once had, so we know that we also need Vasel Mimeno Yagon Nacha. God has to remove the sign, the difficult situations we're in, so that the rabbis will be able to learn and attain the levels that they once attained. Vayal Menucha Kitov Et Aretz Kinaima, he saw the land that it was pleasant. The land is sometimes a mashal for the Torah. He saw the Torah was pleasant. That's something to remember. The Torah is supposed to be pleasant. The ways of the Torah are pleasant. If a person learns something and he infers from there that he must do something that is unpleasant, so he should consult with his rabbis. Maybe he misunderstood it. Maybe there's another way of doing it. We always strive to do things in the most pleasant way. Vayet Shichmo, he tilted himself to carry the weight of the Torah. So when a person wants to learn Torah, he has to tilt himself. You know, the ancient philosophers, I don't know if it was Aristotle or Plato, they wrote that in an ideal academy, a student would walk in and learn for 2 years without asking a single question. Sometimes you walk in, you want to learn, you have to listen. So it always amazes me. We have here people coming after years of learning, sometimes they themselves taught. We sometimes have here people who are conservative or reform rabbis, and then they decide they want to learn and see what this is all about. And they come in after they've been giving sermons, and they sit here and they listen. That's not so easy. For a person to do that, but you want to learn Torah, so a person does have to go down and listen. Yaakov gives blessing to Dan, and he ends his blessing about Dan. He sees how Shimshon, Samson, he's going to have the terrible end. He's going to die with after collapsing the building and killing thousands of Philistines. And he says, "Lishuat Chakivit Hashem, I am hoping for your salvation." And that pasuk has special powers. The pasuk Lishuat Chakivit Hashem has within it secret names of God. That if one says the pasuk forward and backward 3 times, then we say that within it is the name of an angel that protects the person when he's traveling from his enemies. And it was this pasuk that Shimshon himself said in order to attain the strength to bring down the house, excuse the pun. And that's why some have the custom that when they say Tfilas HaDerech, they say this pasuk. Only the custom is We don't actually ever end up saying it backwards. We say Yishuatcha Kiviti Hashem. Kiviti Hashem Yishuatcha. Hashem Yishuatcha Kiviti. And the real way of saying it backwards would be Hashem Kiviti Yishuatcha, which we do not say. I don't know why. That's a question that's posed. Yosef goes to bury his father. We're skipping towards the end of the parasha. We'll focus a little bit on Yosef's blessings. Yosef is described as one who held back his bow, spread out his arms. So one understanding is he pulled back the bow, spread out his arms, he's strong. Another understanding is that his brothers wanted to shoot him dead, and he held back his bow. He never shot back. Quite the contrary, he helped out his brothers. We have a tradition that this pasuk refers to the time that Potiphar's wife grabbed him alone in the house. And the bow is a modest way of referring to something else, that he contained himself. And the tradition has it that he saw that he will not be able to contain himself, and in spite of that he held himself, and that 10 drops of semen came out, and they came out, according to one medrash, through the fingers of his hand. And corresponding to those 10 drops, he lost 10 tribes. He was supposed to have 12 tribes coming out of him himself, and he held himself back, but nonetheless he was excited. And the fact was that as much as he held himself back, the Medrash has it that 10 drops came out. 10 drops came out in vain, but according to one Medrash they just came out, according to another version they came out of the fingers of his hand, and because of that he lost the right step of tribes. He only had 2. His strength comes from Yaakov. It was Yaakov's vision that he saw in the window. Yaakov tells him, my blessings are greater than your blessings. Whenever I'm by my in-laws, so my father-in-law blesses all the kids, and I merit to get a blessing from him too, and then I bless my kids. From Germanic descent, that's our custom, that we bless the kids every Friday night. Then the blessing of the Kohanim. So I always try to get my blessing before I bless my son, my kids. Why? Because Yaakov tells his children, he says, your father, he tells Yosef, your father's blessing is better than my father's blessing. Why? Because Abraham blessed, Yitzchak got a blessing from God. Yitzchak gave that blessing to Yaakov. So now Yosef is getting a build-up. Yosef is getting the blessing from Yaakov, who got the blessing from Yitzchak, who got the blessing, etc. So I always feel, why should I give my son the blessing before I get the blessing? I first go to get my blessing, then I go and give him the blessing. Because of this puzzle, what Yaakov tells his son, says, your father's blessing is better than my father's blessing. I want to end with a few points to bother you guys, but there are bothersome points within our tradition, and you guys have to be aware of them. So officially class is over. I was asked to announce at 10 o'clock. Whoever wants can leave. We're going to take another 5-10 minutes. I think it'll be 5 minutes, just to cover a few points that every person should know. Yaakov left the tradition for his sons how to carry him, which tribes would carry the bed on which side, and this corresponded to where the tribes were situated when we traveled through the desert. Yosef as a king didn't carry, and Levi, who would have the priest, the Kohanim, didn't carry. And when we headed back to bury, when the tribes headed back to bury Yaakov, so Yosef took with him a large number of forces. And if you read in Yosef Ben Gurion in Josephus, you'll see that he records that while Yosef was traveling, so Esav's grandson attacked. Esav had a son named Eliphaz, who had a son named Tzifo. And that son Tzifo brought his forces together, and he did not want to see Yaakov buried in the Maaret HaMachpelah, and he attacked. And there was a tremendous war, and that's why the pasuk stresses that everyone came back to the land of Egypt. So, according to this understanding, the pasuk is stressing that in spite of the tremendous wars we had to fight, as we were traveling, we were being ambushed, as the people were traveling to the land of Canaan, no one died in those wars. We didn't lose a single man. And everyone made it back to Egypt. The medrash that's well known, which your children will come home from Gan telling you, is that when they came to bury Yaakov, so Esav came up with his men, and they rode up, and they said, what do you think you're doing? So they said, we're burying our father here. And Esav said, he took Leah from me, and he buried her here. Remember, Leah was the firstborn. Esav always thought he's going to marry her, and Yaakov married her. And when Yaakov married her, Esav had a good laugh. He said, good, I got the prettier one, I got Rachel. And when Rachel saw that Leah was married and she got word that Esav was rubbing his hands together, Rachel got very scared. Until finally Yaakov took Rachel. And that's why Yosef protects his mother Rachel from being seen by Esav when they come in. He's scared maybe Esav's going to have a claim. Hey, she's mine. You took the elder, so I get the younger. And now Leah's buried, and Esav walks up and says, fine, he took one spot. There were two spots left in here, and I get the other spot. And the guys tell him, no, you sold it. We have the contract. So he says, show me the contract. So the tribes say, well, we left it back in Egypt. So he says, well, I'm not letting you in without a contract. And you have many nations of the world sent their representatives to that to honor Yaakov. As they were traveling, every nation that they passed saw the great honor that Yaakov was given. The Egyptian people were following him. So every nation sent their crown and placed it around Yaakov's bed. So you have representatives, you have a mini UN. You have representatives from every nation standing there. And Esav is saying, I'm not letting you guys go in. So the tribe said, fine, we'll show you the contract. They send Naphtali, who's swift like a young ram. They send him back to Egypt. They say, you go get the contract. Naphtali starts running. Now Yaakov had a grandson there who was deaf. His name was Hushim ben Dun. Dun's grandson Hushim. And he was deaf. He couldn't hear. And he sees that they're standing with the body, and 70 days passed before they could begin traveling to bury him in Israel. Now the whole journey, they're standing there after this whole long journey, there's the entrance to the cave, and Grandpa's lying there in the heat, and no one's moving. So he walks over, and he starts making signs to other people, what's going on here? So the people make signs back, and they explain, you see that big guy there, Esav, he's not letting us go in. So he says, he points, that guy? They say, yeah, that guy. So he goes and gets a shovel and knocks Esav heads off. He says, now you guys can go bury him. Knocks it off, he takes the shovel and knocks Esav's head off his shoulders. Esav's dead. And that's why Rachel said, Rivka foretold Yaakov, she said, why leave, I don't want you to stick around. Esav's upset at you. Why should I bury both of you in one day? Lama eshkol gam shmechem yom echad. And Rashi says, anyone who buries a child is called shakul. In other places, Rashi says, anyone who loses a child is called shakul. But here, Rivka was alluding, she was saying, why should I bury both of you in the same day? They didn't both die in the same day, but they were both buried in the same day. Esav's head rolled, and one medrash has it that it rolled onto Yaakov. Yaakov opened his eyes and smiled. Another medrash has it that his head rolled into the Maaret HaMachpelah. This is the more well-known medrash. And his head got buried in the Maaret HaMachpelah. Yaakov was buried in the Maaret HaMachpelah, and the rest of Esav's body was not. And throughout your lives, you'll hear many drushes as to why Esav merited to have his head buried in the Maaret HaMachpelah. That's not for us to deal with. The last thing we have to deal with here is Yosef and his brothers. Yosef's brothers come and they tell him a lie. And this lie is quoted in the Midrashim, in the special chapter we have about the importance of peace, to show that you're allowed to lie for peace. The brothers were scared there's going to be civil war. Yosef's going to take it out against them. Why were the brothers scared? So, one Midrash has it that as they were returning from burying Yaakov, they passed by the pit where they had placed Yosef. And Yosef passed by the pit. He made the special blessing that one makes when he has a miracle occurred in. And the brothers saw that Yosef remembered full well where was the pit that he had been thrown in. And when they saw that, they said, uh-oh, maybe the bad feelings are coming back. So they came and they said, we're all your servants. God said, your father said before he died, you should make peace with us. Please forgive us. We beg you, please forgive us. We'll be your servants. And Yosef says, you think I'm not a God-fearing person? Of course, I won't do anything bad to you. The other understanding says that until his father died, out of respect to his father, he'd always invite his brothers to come and eat with him. He'd show them extra kindness. And now that his father died, he didn't feel he owed it to them. We never find that Yosef forgave his brothers. And many, many generations later, during the period after the destruction of the Second Temple, during the period of the Mishnah, the Roman Empire decreed, during a period of a number of years, to brutally execute 10 of our greatest sages, Rabbi Akiva among them, as we learned this past Sunday. The Asara Arugei Malchus, the 10 that were killed by the Roman Empire, we have a tradition, in heaven, they were taken instead of the 10 tribes. The 10 tribes have a debt at the end of the book of Bereishis that they haven't paid. We don't find that Yosef forgave them, and the halacha says that one who hurts a fellow man, so heavens will not forgive him until that fellow man forgives him. Whether Yosef did or did not forgive his brothers is a point to wonder. Some say he did not. And the answers that Yosef gives his brothers and his brother's response to him certainly seem to indicate that he did not. The commonly accepted approach and understanding of the end of the parasha is that Yosef said, God forbid, of course we're all one, etc. But that doesn't have to be the understanding in the parasha. And if he did forgive them, then we'd have to wonder, why did we have to lose 10 of our greatest sages? Those of you who want to see more about the Asara Arugei Malchus and understanding what's going on there, you could see the Rabbeinu Bechaye at the end of this week's parasha. I don't want to end on a sad note, we always end on a happy note. So the Yaakov told his children, he said, he tells Yosef, your father's blessing is better than my father's blessing. The story is told that Rothschild once saw his father, once saw his son spending a lot of money, and he was spending it like there was no tomorrow. So at some point he called him in and he said, son, I want to understand, why do you feel like you could allow yourself to spend money like this? I don't allow myself to spend money like this. So he told him, well, your father isn't the same Rothschild that's my father. Shabbat shalom.